This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to James Sherry. He is the founder and publisher of Roof Books and also of Segway Foundation, which is essentially the underlying foundation that operates Roof and also does a lot of other things in the arts in New York City. Hi, James. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. We've known each other a long time. We go back to, I don't even know how long.
Late 70s, I think.
Yeah, I think so. But maybe you should, you know, start from the beginning and talk about Roof and how you got started as a, you know, poetry publisher just from the beginning.
Well, it was interesting that I started out as a writer piano player named Peter Serkin said, oh, you should go to Naropa because that's where all the poets hang out every summer. So I had met Bill Burroughs in Tangier and Brian Geisen and that crew. So I was pleased to be able to go out there. And when I got there, I realized that no one was doing anything to memorialize the events. And you had, in addition to Burroughs and Ginsberg and Ann Waldman, Ted Berrigan, Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, John Eshbery.
Ed Dorn was there.
Ed Dorn. Yes. Pretty much everybody who you wanted to pay attention to as a young writer in the U.S. scene was out there. So along with Tom Savage, I started Roof Magazine, which was designed to just capture all of the people who were there, both the older famous writers and the younger ones. And then that acted as a magnet once that had been published to attract a lot of younger writers who wanted to be in the same magazine that that these famous writers
And if I remember correctly, when you first started Roof, it was 8.5 by 11.
8.5 by 11.
Staple bound.
No, it was perfect bound.
Okay.
It was done. It was a donation. The publishing, the printing was a donation that I got. So it was done in a very commercial way. And I liked that commercial aspect rather than the fine printing aspect of it. Because it just acted as a pure repository for the work.
And did you have a frequency for the magazine in mind at first, or did
The magazine was intended as a quarterly, and it was published for 10 issues quarterly. At which point, I decided it was just too difficult to publish 100 pages every quarter.
It's a lot of work.
It was a huge amount of work, and so I started publishing books. In fact, the magazine started out with, you know, one or two poems per writer, and then eventually got to longer and longer sections. And very soon I found that not only would I be interested in the writing from the New York School and the San Francisco Renaissance and Black Mountain, but the emerging writers, particularly the language poets, caught my attention, and I was more engaged with them as the issues went along. And I published a section of San Francisco writers and a section of DC writers, trying to capture these different tendencies in a community sense, rather than just focus on the individual poets. We got the best writing we could from each person, but also contextualized them with the people that they were speaking to and reading especially carefully.
So what year was your first book published? When was this taking place?
The first book was in 1979. So 3 years, basically 3 years after I started publishing the magazine, the first book came out. And the first two books were Charles Bernstein's Controlling Interests and Hannah Wiener's Little Books Indians, which was Little Books Indians was quite a feat, because she had written it in these very small marble notebooks all over the pages, and translating that into a 6x9 book was quite a challenge.
I remember that book very well. So maybe talk a little bit more about how the publishing evolved? You know, at, you know, when you were first publishing, it was at this point, you know, let's say early 80s. You know, how many books were you publishing every year?
I pretty much stuck to 4 books a year throughout the cycle of the press, and it's going on still, because I wanted to keep control over the number of people that I would have to deal with, partly because since it's poetry publishing, I had no illusions about making a living at it, and also because I liked the idea of a more formal practice of publishing rather than having it capture anything that came across the transom. And basically, I'd never really accepted unsolicited manuscripts and spent my time reading, finding out who was doing work that I thought was either exciting or cutting edge or different than someone else or particularly good example of the genre. And so that took a lot of my time, too, because I was really spending a lot of time reading other magazines, going to poetry readings, and talking to people.
And at what stage did you decide to create the foundation?
The foundation came in right away. The first issue of the magazine was published in the fall of 76. And then in 77, I realized when I started asking people for money that they wanted some benefit out of it. So we established the foundation in May of 77.
So that was very right. Unlike many of the publishers that I've talked to have become nonprofit over the years at various times, it was usually an evolution. So you're, you know, somewhat singular in that you started out as a nonprofit.
Yes, pretty much, because I was never under the illusion of profitability. In fact, I've always said that if I can buy a piece of paper for a penny, but if I put a poem on it, I can't give it away.
Negative, reverse value.
Yes, it's sort of a, you know,
right.
Yes.
So
Keatsian concept.
So you started Segue Foundation, and what aside from publishing, Segue has done many other things, and I'm kind of interested in, was that a planned planning on your part, or was there accident involved and, you know, circumstance that opened doors for you and or people suggesting things to you, or did, you know, you really kind of drove the idea of having an arts foundation as a bigger thing?
I think both happened. I knew right away that because I had spent my time as a young unpublished writer and knew how hard the whole process was and knew that there was an ecosystem of poetry that extended beyond the writer and the poem, even beyond the book and the distribution to the environment in which all of the poetry inhabited. So I knew that when I created the foundation, I created it explicitly to promote and support the literary environment. And so we did things like took over the reading series that Ted Greenwald started at the Ear Inn and have been running that since 1981. We built some artist housing in collaboration with the city at 303 East 8th Street, and also acted as a conduit for other arts organizations that needed that tax exemption.
I was really interested to, you know, read about the building, you know, that because that's a really major undertaking. It's one thing to publish a magazine and even publish books for this many years, but to wrestle with New York City real estate and the city of New York itself, that's a pretty major accomplishment.
Truth be told, most of the work was done by the people who ended up living there rather than me or anybody, you know, as directly associated with the foundation. I was able to help with some resources, but by and large, the artists who were involved in the house, in the building, did most of the legwork.
And does that building still exist as an artist housing?
The building is there as artist housing. I think its bylaws after the 25-year period kind of became more flexible. But the value that for the artists, for people who worked in nonprofit arts, they were buying their their lofts, 1,200 square foot loft for $30,000, and now they're worth more than a million.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
It was very good for the artists who got involved.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you currently operate a reading. I know you have the reading series, and maybe how has that evolved over? I mean, because it's a 35 years of running readings in New York City is a lot of history.
Yeah, it started out focused mostly on language poetry and New York school. But what I've done since then, in the last 10 or 15 years, is started to bring in younger writers. And the way it works is every 2 months from October through May, a pair of young writers curates seven or eight readings on a Saturday. And to bring in themselves and their friends to kind of identify what they're doing, to make it clear that they have some independent and useful idea, as well as a bunch of great work that they're going to present to, you know, themselves, their friends, but also to some of the people who kind of follow the series, who know that there's something interesting going to be going on a Saturday.
So do you have people who have been coming to the series for years and years and years?
Yes, there are people who, you know, some of the same people from 1980, you know, are still showing up at the series. But what's most exciting is that there continue to be young people, and now the room is filled with people in their 20s, and that is very gratifying to me.
So how would you characterize the difference, and we talked about this a little bit earlier before we started recording, the difference in the way that you see the world of poetry? I could call it the poetry scene in New York City in particular, because you're here. You know, how do you see it as today in 2016 being different from, say, 1981, 35 years ago, when you really, you know, when you were beginning the work?
There's a far larger group of writers. There are many more people writing and many more people paying attention to writing, reading books. The number of books that even Roof sells, even though we still publish the same four books a year, selling a lot more copies of each one, partly because there are a lot more people writing, partly because there are a lot more different tendencies in writing, because as the number has expanded, the different types and kinds and angles that people slice their language has expanded to the point where it's pretty unpredictable how many different tendencies you might see at any one moment. But right now, instead of, as there was in 1980, pretty much the active groups were the New York School and the language poets. There was some identity-focused writing, particularly in the Black community, and now it's expanded. The poetry world has expanded to include, you know, all the different gender groups, different racial groups, not just, you know, Black poets, but the Asian American writers have done some amazing work. There have been a lot of people focused on more aesthetic kinds of writing, where that's less hard-edged. There are just an expanded number of people and groups of people trying to make their ideas known.
Do you see anybody could say this for sure, but do you see a communication between the various different tendencies or groups, as you might call them, that within this expanded world of poetry, do you think it's more an explosion of, you know, individual stars rather than of a communication among the different groups and tendencies?
I have a kind of explicit theory about this, whether it's true or not, and that is that the individual stars is really something that happens later. What actually occurs is a proliferation, as you say, explosion of different tendencies and forms, different ways of slicing and dicing the language that people work on, try, and then if they're successful, they start to publish. But they publish and talk in groups, small groups of 2, 3, 4 people, and that ends up producing a kind of writing, let's say Florff writers, of which there were, you know, there were 10 maybe in the whole group. They had a big splash in the early 2000s with a very effective kind of global reach. People like Nada Gordon going to Japan and Burma, a lot of work done in Europe, people were in Germany, all coming out of this small group of writers who were focused on generating text through Google searches. So they take a Google string, put it in the computer, and then generate a bunch of text and then work on that text. So that group had certain writers who became more, who did it better or who had a greater audience, and those people became important. But the way it got started was because of people talking together. Same thing is true with the conceptual writers coming out of conceptual art, things that we language poets had done in the 70s and 80s with genre writing and using pre-existing texts, then became a kind of pure form in the hands of someone like Kenny Goldsmith or Vanessa Place or Rob Fitterman, to the point where they had this notion of radical appropriation, where they would actually take a text, put a new cover on it, and call it a new work. And there are various reasons why this was interesting to people. It became so interesting that Kenny Goldsmith was at the White House. He was on network television, and then it imploded with the events that we know about last year.
So, do you feel like if you had to kind of summarize the role of Segway and Roof Books, how would you put it? You know, in the world of poetry.
Well, Segway in the sense that it means musically to connect without a bridge. I keep trying to identify different groups or individuals and keep trying to put them together. Because to me, the poets are important and the groups of poets are important, but there's a third component, and that is the network that connects them, the places they go to, the way they talk to each other, the journals and book series that they use. All of these are conduits for the writing and for the ideas. So those three components working together seem to me to be the important way in which all of this takes place, rather than focusing on the, you know, single star or the group. I like the idea of talking about this network that includes individuals, groups, and the things that connect them.
So in your day job, you know, in your the way you made your living was in computer programming, is that right? So,
right.
Did some ideas from the world of networking influence the way you think about poetry?
Yeah, some of my patents are involved with network communications, computer to computer languages, and ways of sending messages from one thing to another, and some of those models inform the way in which I think about publishing, or I think about the poetry world, or I think about the world of ideas that informs poetry.
Does it work the other way around too?
I've tried to get some of the technology people interested in some of these ideas, and they are interested in them so long as they are abstract. But once the word poetry creeps in, people are still stuck on the notion of poetry as some sort of personal expression.
Right.
Especially in the science world, because they want to differentiate themselves from anything else to say, computers is really separate, you know, unique. We have a special thing going on. The same way that any person tries to separate themselves from the rest of the universe. Otherwise, you wouldn't know how to breathe or eat or do any of the things that you do if you didn't in some way identify yourself.
But do you feel that for you, the ability to bridge the world of machine code and poetry is important?
For me, it was vital because it was a way in which I felt I could have a stable place to sit. That is, my stool had enough legs to stay on the floor. By understanding something about the world and something about poetry, and to find a way to connect them.
So I want to go back to some of the kind of rudimentary or practical things about publishing poetry, just because I think, you know, I'm interested in it. I hope other people are too. But, you know, you mentioned that the books you're publishing today are selling better than the books you published years ago. And I was struck by that because in the world of publishing and bookselling, it's generally considered to have, you know, the world has, the broadness of the marketplace has been reduced. There are fewer bookstores, fewer outlets for literary books. And so the kind of common wisdom might be that, you know, books of poetry might be selling less well because there are fewer places for them to sell. But it's interesting that that's not the case for you. Today, how do most of your books get sold? What's the mechanism for that to take place?
I would say there are a variety of channels. One is obviously through bookstores. We do a lot of, because of the success of the early writers that I published, language poetry in particular, there's a lot of sales to universities and classrooms. And so instead of
selling— Because those poets are now, they have now become part of the canon.
That's right. So instead of selling one copy, you sell 30 copies.
Right.
So that immediately helps. And some of the older books, you know, have continued to sell because as you say, they've become part of the canon. There's also sales going on because I've produced about a third of the titles as ebooks. And while they don't sell wonderfully, some of them have sold quite a few copies of ebooks because I'm selling them at the lowest price that I can. So for a classroom to say, take a copy of a Fiona Templeton book, which we did, only because a teacher said, I want this book and I'm going to Xerox it. I said, don't do that. I'll make it available for $3.99 as an ebook for your classes. And so that it enabled the students to buy it. It also enabled the teacher not to violate copyright.
That's right. So when you do that, I'm interested in publishing poetry as ebook is sometimes challenging because of the layout issues. But when you do that, are you publishing these as PDFs with fixed pages that essentially are matching the printed book, or are you producing Kindles and EPUB?
Right. So we're doing Kindle and EPUB, PRC and EPUB format books, and it does take a lot of effort to do that. So there's a lot of proofing and back and forth between the translator and our office, making sure things get right. And if things get too complex, we can take an individual page or group of pages and shoot them as an image.
Right. Yeah, because there have been complaints. I think vividly recalling a book of Allen Ginsberg's published by a publisher I will not mention, that when it was converted, as they say, to an ebook, the formatting went away and it looked like one long sentence. It was
right.
Terrible.
And that sort of thing does happen. The particular problem with the translation is precisely the spacing problem.
Right.
It doesn't usually make errors with words or letters, but rather with the spaces.
Right.
So we just spend a lot of time going back and forth and do a lot of iterations of each one.
So do you have the goal to digitize all of the books, or is it more situational based on there being some interest and demand?
Let's say the jury's still out on that one. I'm happy to keep doing it so long as there continues to be interest. What I'm noticing, though, is a leveling off in sales of ebooks, because I think that a lot of people have kind of lowered their expectations of how they want these things to be seen. And the rise of the cell phone technology, the smartphone technology, means that people have the ability to look at stuff and seem to be less interested in how it looks than that they can just get the piece and have it on their tablet or their iPhone.
Do you mean by that they're less interested in buying an ebook because they have access to so much content on the phone?
Right.
Because the internet is ubiquitous for you with a smartphone.
So we have to fit in. I think we as publishers have to fit into that stream of information not expect that we have a privileged channel.
So that in potentially unbundling the book a bit, you know, into the I mean, I've thought about this a lot, that the book, you know, there was a conference that went on in San Francisco for a few years called Books and Browsers that made me think of this, which was the idea that, you know, the book as a is reflective of a container environment when people have, when they're reading on cell phones or smartphones and tablets, and they're potentially reading through the internet, you publish differently. You're not publishing an ebook as a digital equivalent of the print book. It could be that you would publish into the stream, essentially.
Right, and it's precisely that stream concept, I think, that informs the way people read and think about information now. And so the notion of a poem is actually become more important in the contemporary environment than the concept of the book, because the book as the container is really superseded by the container of the tablet or the smartphone. So we need to fit into that stream, and that's precisely what I think we're doing.
Do you think that I mean, this is a little bit of a sideline, but thinking about I think about novels as a kind of creation of the mechanics of publishing of the 19th century, 18th century maybe, and wonder if the notion of the book also, because it is essentially a creation of some technology that may or may not be around forever, whether the notion of how a bunch of poems are collected or put together into a body of work is also then open for discussion.
Yeah, I think rather than one thing superseding another, I think of it like Coca-Cola. There used to be Coca-Cola. Then there was New Coke. Then there was Diet Coke. Then there was caffeine-free Coke. Then there was et cetera. And it's not that there's a few less sales of regular Coke, but by and large, there's a whole lot more Coca-Cola products being sold.
In other words, you're right, a Coke for every user, so you could have poetry in a collection of all different ways. You know, you could have a traditional book that's printed. You could have a digital book that's a different format, a different expression of the idea of the book, or you could have books in the, you know, kind of collections of poems that are not even defined as books.
I think that's the point, that we start to get multiplicity. And that, again, the same idea that we were talking about, this explosion or proliferation of forms characterizes the contemporary situation.
But at the same time, and it just, this goes to your point, actually, that the physical reading is still important, that it isn't superseded by the availability of, I mean, the incredible and wonderful availability of pen sound and, you know, online sources of audio. People want to go out and hear poets read out loud. And the fact that you can read almost anything online still does not prevent people from wanting to read the physical, you know, can possess and read a physical object.
Yeah, and also the fact that some poems stand by themselves very well, very effectively, and some poems are clearly part of a larger thought. So you have a cycle of poems which you'd like to read together, and you inevitably would get more out of than reading any individual poem, as opposed to the sense of anthology of a collection that might be arbitrary or have a theme, right, not necessarily to read them together. Those kinds of poems fit very nicely into the digital media.
Yeah, I can think of some works of poetry by contemporary poets that were broken up into pieces because no publisher could afford to publish the whole thing. You know, it might have been, if you did it as a book, it would have been 1,000 pages, and that's just not practical. So you'll see work, you know, scattered over, and for the writer and for the reader, that is kind of anti-contextual. It doesn't allow the work to live and breathe in the way that it was intended by the poet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that also that the idea of intention is now being questioned as well. And that's a big issue, because part of that 19th century idea was to focus on the intention of the writer as some sort of instantiation of imagination that was greater than the writer and that exemplified the best spirit of humanity. As we move away from that romantic romantic idea, the notion of intention starts to fade.
So we'll go back again to the, like, thinking about the, like, the practical stuff. So Segway and Roof has been around for more than 35 years. And as a nonprofit, you have, I assume you have a board of directors. And so do you have an idea, like, for what the future will be? Are you going to pass this on to someone else? Do you have plans for it to continue?
I would like for it to continue. And I'm, in fact, at my age, starting to look around for people who would like to, you know, take it over and work with it. So yes, I'm working on that.
Right. Cause I mean, you have, you know, it's an interesting issue for anyone who creates an, what essentially becomes an institution or, it has a life of its own.
Yeah. And you see that with the, you know, institution like the Poetry Project, where it's a lot of, right. Some of the people who started it aren't active anymore. And I'm hoping that this, you know, that I can do the same thing on the scale that's relevant to what Segway is doing.
Right. Well, it's an interesting challenge for anyone to think about.
Well, things are coming out of the woodwork. It's more, again, as we were asking before, people are saying, oh, well, we'd like to, you know, be part of this. We'd like you to take our interns and teach them what you're doing. We'd like your archive. We want the, you know, right. To treat the institution as an entity, whereas to me, it was always, as you say, just a stream of events.
Right.
That was going on that I kept trying to add to and enhance. Now it's starting to look more like an institution.
Right. Well, because it began and was for so many years, or is, you know, an expression of your creativity. And that's, I assume you've done most of this by yourself.
Most of the selection process was done by me, but I have to say that I certainly took a lot of input from other people. And if for example, you look at the Segway reading series, which has been going on for all these years, as I said, by bringing in these younger writers, the readings that I go to at the series act as a slush pile for me, and I'm able to hear a lot more diverse stuff edited by the curators that run the series. So I get to hear the best of the new writers in this genre, the best of the new writers from that group, some, you know, spectacular eccentric who someone found and, you know, puts into the stream. So that process has been very useful.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as you were saying that in fact there is an interactivity between the poetry reading series and the publishing. That is singular as well. I think, you know, there are not many publishers who have engaged in that communal effort.
And part of that is because I just hate to say no. So the idea of inviting people to submit works blindly, you know, over the transom or through a slush pile, it's never been satisfactory for me. So I prefer keeping myself as informed as I can about who's doing what to whom and where.
And so now, over these all of years, you've published more than 150 books, is that right?
About.
Yeah. So that's a pretty... major accomplishment.
It is. I mean, it's not as many as some of the publishers who've taken their commercial responsibilities more seriously than I, but 150 books was a pretty good run.
I think it's a lot of books, and a lot of them extremely important.
I've had some luck with having, you know, being able to tap into a pool of interesting writers and gotten some of the better texts that I could publish, and also of being able to introduce writers through their early works to people who then, you know, were able to pick it up in a more commercial way. A lot of the writers that I published in Roof Magazine, like Ray Armantrout, won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. Charles Bernstein obviously has been very successful. Ron Silliman has published widely, you know, huge production of stuff, and I was lucky to publish his book, The New Sentence, as well as some of his poetry books.
So do you feel like, I mean, some of the poets, obviously not from New York, but do you feel that your being in New York has been an important component? It's, you know, it's be hard to separate you from New York City in so many ways.
I suspect that's the case, that I'm in New York, but I like to think of it as a national and even an English language press.
Oh, I didn't mean by saying that to limit the scope, but the fact that you're in New York has been so much part of the being of the press and the involvement of the series, the reading series in the publishing. It's all because you're here.
Yeah, people tend to show up here at one point or another.
It'd be hard to run I would suspect more difficult to run an ongoing reading series in some other parts of the country.
Right. And there are a few places, you know, as you know, San Francisco and LA and New York, Chicago. And some of the universities have done a very good job of building programs with funding that have attracted a lot of writers and a lot of interesting different tendencies in writing.
Right. But you've done it without a larger institution. So in a way, it's the community of New York that's enabled you, I think.
I see your point, and I agree totally. Yeah. I think it's the community that makes Segway work.
Yeah. I think that's really important. Well, James, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. I hope we've covered at least, it's not meant to be comprehensive, but I think we've covered a lot of ground and really appreciate it.
Well, it was a great pleasure to get together after all these years of not seeing each other. Thank you for inviting me, David.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to James Sherry of Roof Books and Segway Foundation.